Welcome to the Parent Equation Podcast with me, Aisha Murray. This podcast series is full of inspiring stories from working parents who are passionate about designing a life that works for them and their families. Working parents like you who want a purposeful, rewarding career alongside a balanced family life. Today on the Parent Equation, I'm joined by Anita Clear. Anita is the founder of the Positive Parenting Project and also the author of the work Parent Switch. So welcome, Anita. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you are coming to me live and direct from Portugal, embracing the true meaning of hybrid working.
I am indeed. And I do not want anybody to think this is something I do all the time. I actually have been moaning about the fact that flexible working, we talk about its advantages, we talk about being digital nomads. The closest I normally get to it is working in a cafe. And I have been working very hard and I need a holiday, but I can't take one right now because of work, and decided I'd do a bit of a hybrid kind of experience. So it's part holiday, part work, and yeah, off season. We managed to get somewhere last minute. I am really enjoying it.
I think that's, well, it shows, doesn't it, how things have moved on, I suppose.
I'm lucky my children are a bit older now, and they are at that age where I can leave them, not only leave them to look after themselves, but they can also look after the house and all of the practical side of things. So I have waited for this moment for their whole lives when I would be able to do that. And it's here. So if nothing else, people should take hope from that. If you've got little ones, you too will be able to do this at some stage.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it, with parenting and being a busy working parent, is that we don't want to wish the time away, obviously. We want to be present in the moment. But when you have got younger kids and you've got that, the immense juggle and the emotional needs that they have and the emotional needs you have for work, etc., you do find yourself waiting for the moments that you're experiencing, but then also trying to maintain your presence at the same time.
Yeah, and I think it's okay to admit how much energy and effort it takes to be a parent and to be a working parent, especially. It's okay to do that. And we mustn't feel like we're either failing at it or that we are not good enough at it if we're turn around and say, actually, it's hard, because it is hard. You know, young children are just all consuming, and it's difficult to bring yourself to that all the time. And I think we reset when we admit that this is difficult. And it's that moment where you reset and you try and refresh and you think, right, what do I need to do differently? Just take a breath and go again. And we shouldn't be afraid to say, yes, this is difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're highly experienced in this area. You've been doing this a very long time. And the Work Parent Switch, I mean, the name sort of explains kind of what it is. So what do you think, I suppose, in all of your years of insights and working with different people and your own personal story, of course, what are the biggest challenges facing working parents, do you think?
I think feeling like we're succeeding, because so many of the working parents I talk to feel like they are letting people down or letting themselves down, or not quite managing either to be the parent they want to be, or to deliver at work the way they want to deliver, or indeed to look after themselves. So it's those expectations and feeling like we should be getting all of it right. Whereas ultimately you never can get everything right. We always have higher expectations. We always could be doing better. So being able to look at what you're doing as a parent and take those thoughts, whether they're guilt thoughts or worry thoughts, and decide, are they helpful? And if sometimes those thoughts are helpful, because it makes you think, yes, you know what, I did shout at my child because I was stressed, or I do need to be there a little bit more often. Sometimes they're useful and we should listen to them. And sometimes we should just completely blow them away and say, no, that's not true. I can't, you know, I don't need to do it that well. I don't need to be perfect. I am doing okay. And that is a constant struggle, managing that internal dialogue of how well am I doing? Am I doing this well enough? And that comes up with parents, no matter how old their children are.
And it's also tied to that, the comparison and the world that we all operate in nowadays. And, you know, people like us who run our businesses online or have to run them online and be present online, which is a scary place to be. That brings that whole comparisonitis into stark reality, doesn't it? And not only do we not think we're good enough, but we're seeing other people doing it better, with these sort of Instagram filtered lives, how can we, I suppose, how can we best avoid, apart from being off it altogether, which I know is obviously going to be strong advice, but generally speaking, how can we protect ourselves from that, do you think?
I think, you know, we've written ourselves a massive job description and we keep putting more things in it. And every time we go online, we put in another thing into our parenting job description. Oh, I should be doing that. Look, this person is doing this with their child, or their child is having this type of birthday party or learning that type of musical instrument. And as modern parents, we have just got this huge sackload of things, of benchmarks, of performance metrics that we feel like we should be meeting as parents. Mm-hmm. We've got to simplify that. I mean, I have the advantage now I've got older kids. It also means that I'm older myself. And I look back to my childhood and my parents did not have, I mean, a tenth of the things in their parenting kind of to-do list that I do. You know, my dad's version of being a good parent was, you know, giving me a Coke and sitting me on the swings while he went and did something else. And really different approach. And I'm not saying that was right, that kind of benign neglect of the 70s. But we've gone a little bit too far the other way. We have to, you know, do all of these things we feel like we're failing if the kids aren't, you know, doing a sport, if they're not learning a musical instrument, playing chess, doing well at school. We use those to judge ourselves as parents. And that's a real trap, doing that, because we're comparing our kids to other kids, our parenting to other parenting or other parents that we see online. And actually, when it comes down to it, we have our child, or, you know, collection of them, if we've got more than one, they're the people in front of us. And really, parenting is about our relationship with them, and it's about that person. And it's so easy to get distracted by all of that stuff online, and add, it's one more stick to beat ourselves with when we think, oh, I haven't done that with my kids, or I should be doing that.
I think it's probably even more of a thing post COVID, because of, I think, well, this is my experience potentially, during lockdown, we were all in the house together, and lots of people who took it upon themselves, rightly, to create online schooling, I suppose, for kids, for us to take from. So not just the schooling from our actual schools, but there were things you could look at online. There was Instagram building craft stuff, science clubs, all this stuff online. I thought, oh my God, look at these parents who are being so kind of resourceful. And they're not just doing this stuff for the kids, they're putting it online and, you know, now have thousands of followers. Oh my God, why aren't I doing all this stuff? So I think it feels a bit more than it used to be.
Yeah.
The sort of advent of online learning.
And I think we're often missing the point, because we think, oh, well, I'm encouraging my child to be creative and I'm keeping them busy. Actually, when you look at, you know, what helps build creativity in children, it's the things that they're not getting. It's downtime, it's boredom, it's the ability to make a big mess of stuff and get hands-on and dirty with things. We're a lot more uncomfortable about doing those sorts of things with kids. And yet those activities, or that lack of activity, is how children will build the skill that we're trying to build by putting all that pressure on ourselves to do Instagram-worthy crafts.
Yeah, and it's so hard, because we've talked about this previously, haven't we, about boredom, or I think it was on a LinkedIn post, where one of the mantras in our home is, it's okay to be bored. Yeah. And if our kids say, I'm bored, find something to do. Yeah. I don't help them, I don't give them an answer, I just say, off you go. And it takes the strength of 1,000 elephants for me to not give in and give them a screen or give them, you know, something to do. But eventually, they always find something to do. Yeah. And it's always creative, it's always interesting to them, it's always different, it's always so, but it takes, when you're busy, is that you've got all that stuff in your mind, you've got working parent mental load, all you want to do is say, okay, do you know what, just leave me alone and go and do something.
Yeah.
But to stick to your guns around, just go and find something, it's tough.
It is tough. I think the good news with lots of the things that are tough in parenting is if you actually bite the bullet and do them, and you can be a little bit consistent about that and keep doing it, they then become easy. It's the same with screens, with lots of things. They actually get harder the more we give in to that, the more we say, yep, okay, do this, or direct what our children are doing. Then they want that again, and then they cause the problem again. Whereas if we're consistent and say, nope, that's your problem to solve, they get practiced at doing that themselves, and they're less likely to come and badger us to, you know, solve that boredom problem for them. Yes. So lots of things in parenting are, they feel hard the first time when children push back or make demands, But if we can be consistent just for a little bit, then they usually get easier.
Yeah, good advice. And then your own working parent journey. So obviously looking back now, because now you've obviously got the kids are not out of the picture, obviously, but they're less in the picture from a day-to-day perspective than before. And you run your own very successful business now, etc. So what was it like for you when your kids were much younger, when you were going through those early throes of working motherhood?
So I had a very unusual, shall we say, start to my working parenthood. So my very first career was in international development. So I was working as a country director of an overseas aid development program in Mongolia when I had my first child. So I went for my first pregnancy there. I didn't give birth there. I came back to the UK to do that. But then took him back there after my maternity leave. So that was very unusual, shall we say. It really wasn't the typical start, and we didn't have access to a lot of things that parents would expect to have access to. But it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful to do. I ended up, unfortunately, after the birth of my second child, I ended up as a single parent. So I had a one-year-old and a three-year-old on my own. I was working, so at that stage I realised I couldn't really be gallivanting across the world with two little ones on my own. It would have been a tall order. So I sort of pivoted and went into children's services, which was not dissimilar to what I'd been doing, and had to work. And that was really hard, don't get me wrong. I mean, I look back at it and I wonder, how did I do that? And I say to people sometimes, I had a one-year-old, I had a three-year-old, I was working, albeit I think I was doing 3.5 days a week. I had no support. It was an absolute separation. So no support from my ex-partner. And I was studying for a postgraduate at the same time. And now I think, how did I do that? Absolutely no idea. And I think it was sheer determination. And I don't claim that I was a great parent. At the time, I was really finding my feet in how to do that, and it was quite stressful, and sometimes I found that quite hard. So I think that was a lot of the challenges of being a working parent all at once and very much on my shoulders at the same time. Luckily, because I was working in children's services, there was lots of support around me from other professionals who worked with children, and I knew I had a love of, you know, children in terms of not just my own, but a real fascination with them, real fascination about how they develop. And I was lucky at work to be able to indulge that, to be able to, you know, to go and work in nurseries and be with children, to work with parents, to set up services for parents. So, you know, my job was setting up family support services and managing those programs to try and make parents' lives easier. So, and lots of those I thought, oh gosh, these are services I need. You know, I really need this support. Everybody needs to have this support. So it was an interesting time, shall we say. And maybe I've just kind of got a trauma response and put it into my memory so that I can't quite access how difficult it really was at the time.
I think it just demonstrates, doesn't it, that obviously all working parents have different contexts and scenarios, different personal circumstances, all difficult. To differing levels, but everything's relative. Everything's your own personal difficulty, isn't it? So it is difficult. It's difficult. Not taking that away from anybody. So we all have these lives that are difficult, and there's all these different things happening. But I think what you're saying is, with hindsight, knowing what you went through, we all do a great job. We all do the absolute best we can do in the circumstances we're in.
We do, and you know, and it is that benefit of hindsight. You know, I can remember. There are moments in my children's lives that I remember, which I would take away from them if I could. You know, things that I wish hadn't happened, whether it was, you know, arguments that I had with them, arguments that they witnessed between me and my partner, things that were so less than perfect. One of my sons went on to have an acute mental health crisis in his teenage years, and I would take all of that away from him. However, having come the other side and having seen them develop as people, having had them turn around and say, thanks, Mum, thank you for, you know, for supporting me, for being there and all of that. And I'm sure there are bits that, you know, they don't tell me or aren't thankful for. That does give you a little bit of perspective on it, that we give ourselves an incredibly hard time for a lot of the details, a lot of the small stuff. And we can lose sight of that big picture of their real journey through their lives and, you know, and what that's going to look like in the bigger picture.
And I suppose also there's an argument that they will find their own way,
yes,
you know, as human beings do. And our job is to, obviously, as best we can, guide them and role model for them and support and love and nurture, etc. But ultimately, they are individual people with their own minds, differing beliefs to us. They won't mirror us, that's for sure.
And I think that's quite a liberating thought, really, isn't it? Because we do tend to feel like every little thing we do is important. You know, right from the beginning when they're babies, you know, how you feed them, when you wean, whether they have a pacifier or not, all of these decisions we can really amplify in our heads as being significant. And then the internet says, you know, oh, well, if you do this, this will happen. We're bombarded by information. But actually, we're not in control of any of it, really. We can influence, exactly as you said, we can influence, we can try and guide, but theirs is their own journey, their own life. And we, our job is to stay close to them as much as possible and to walk alongside them through that, if we possibly can stay close to them, to try and guide them. We are not in control. And I think that's a hard thing because we love our children so dearly, so dearly. They are the most important, most precious people to us. We're not in control of the outcomes for them. But if you can accept that and see what that really means in terms of relationship building with them, I think that's quite liberating and takes some of the pressure off.
Yeah. And on a slightly different, slightly tangential, but obviously related to what we're talking about, you obviously also work not just with parents, but you all, I know you do work with organisations and you have experience of how companies are treating their parents, behaving, changing their policies, all these different things. And again, with the sort of last few years that we've been through, but continuing conversations, obviously, every day around what organisations should do, are you seeing a positive shift in the way that companies support their working parents?
I don't know if there's a unified answer to that. I think companies are more and more aware that looking after the whole self of an employee or helping them look after themselves, as you know, in the full dimensions, will help them perform at work. So I think that more rounded sense, and being a parent is a massive part of that. Sometimes I think the working parenthood gets a little bit kind of caught up on things like parental leave and return to work and certain points. And that, you know, I think actually it's hard all the way through the journey. So some firms are fantastic at providing that support and recognizing it, you know, and I love working with those firms, and others are right at the beginning of that journey. And, you know, I hear a variety of different stories on that. I went in last week, I think it was, and did a kit day, a keeping in touch day, which was fantastic because I got to, you know, coo at babies and, you know, always my favourite day at work if I get to do that. But I, you know, I stepped back after that and really thought about how important that was, because lots of firms will do things like a keeping in touch day at that stage. And they will do, you know, negotiations with managers, talk about policies, all of that, try and transition back to work. But when I talk to working parents, I don't know many working parents who, you know, end up switching or pivoting or changing their jobs, which so many of us do. Most of us don't do that because we thought we were bad at our jobs. We do it because we feel like we're not able to be the parent we want to be and do our jobs. And I think that's still a really fundamental kind of dilemma that particularly working mums face, is how do I square that circle? How do I make that work? And where firms could do better is by really supporting parents to feel like they're good parents, you know, and to give them really concrete tools, which is, you know, obviously that's what I try and do. It's what I've tried to do in the book, and say, look, if you can do these things with your kids, if you've got half an hour, 15 minutes, whatever it is, if you can do these things, you will be meeting their needs. So I think there's a bit of tick boxing sometimes.
Yes.
Or gets done.
Yeah, and I think I've definitely experienced that, the sort of the tick box of, and I think I had one conversation recently where she went in for her Keeping Touch day and has sat in a load of meetings all day.
Yeah.
So actually just went to work for a day and then left and got home and, oh, that was a bit out of context. I'm not going back for another 2 months. I was just sort of thrown information and expected to absorb it. And it was entirely the wrong use of a Keeping in Touch day.
Yeah.
So I think, as you say, that it's there, it exists as a thing, but it's not actually used in the best way, most productive way for that individual.
Yeah. And many parents, the most stressful thing that happens to them is becoming the parent of a teenager, you know, that transitional stage. So I think there are so many transitions as a parent, and we need to, you know, make sure that parents are getting support. And the reason I set up the Positive Parenting Project and made that pivot myself from working in, you know, in children's services, partly was my own personal reasons, was me wanting to have a different balance in my life. And that recognition that my children at that time were sort of in that transition towards the teenage years. They were too old to be left in holiday clubs and put in childcare, but too young to be trusted to be on their own. And I really felt like I wanted to be around more, and I wanted to perhaps, you know, rebalance my life. But also that I felt like we need to give parents support in the workplace rather than asking them to come and find support. And that quality really matters. You know, I get really slightly upset about hearing people give parenting advice who aren't trained in giving parenting advice. You know, I put so much store on my professional qualifications, on my academic background, on the 20 years experience that I've got. And working parents deserve that. If you know, they deserve people giving advice who understand children, not just someone who happens to have had a child and therefore feels qualified to give advice. And of course, I came from the public sector where all of that is benchmarked. You can't possibly, you know, give advice unless you are really are using an evidence-based program. You've got appropriate qualifications and you're vetted. And then when I went into the private sector, I was slightly shocked that nobody ever asked really too much about, you know, what my background was or how I felt like I had the experience to do this and what the evidence base was. So I'm a bit of a I do get a little bit cross about lack of evidence base in some of the support that is out there, shall we say.
I also admit it's the same in the wider coaching context, that obviously it's an unregulated industry predominantly, so regulated accredited coaches like myself, like you, and people with the right qualifications and experience and training and CPD and all of these things, who are trying to do the best for our clients and for the wider context, but of course get overshadowed potentially by those who haven't and are just, you know, I say cowboys, some of them are cowboys, and then that sort of, you know, mars
the
whole experience.
It's the world that we live in. I mean, you talked about the social media, the need as a business or as a coach to be on social media kind of promoting yourself. And the fact is, I think we've lost a little bit of critical thinking. We see people who've got big platforms and are making a lot of noise and feel that they are somehow to be trusted rather than really, you know, drilling down and thinking, well, actually, where are you coming from? So, yeah, that metric of how many people are listening isn't directly related to how good is the advice being given.
Which leads straight into our children, who are now being, obviously, your maybe were born just before this complete advent of social media. Were they living in it from a very young age?
Well, interestingly, I think they've grown up with... I didn't have. So, I mean, technology has moved so quickly. So when my kids were born, I did not have a mobile phone. And I very quickly had to get one, but it wasn't a smartphone. It was you know, something that you called and texted on. And by the time they were transitioning into that, mum, I need a phone, you know, sort of secondary school kind of transition, it was all smartphones. And that had happened in their first 10 years, that massive shift. Although, to be fair, when my eldest was at that stage, it was BlackBerrys. Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
CBMing each other. That's what they were doing. So I think they don't remember the world without it. It is where they go for information. They wouldn't dream of looking something up in a book. And, you know, I even had a conversation with my son, and I regard, you know, my kids as being wonderful people and very intelligent, but their blind spots really make me laugh. He was like, yeah, he said, what is it with a stamp? I don't get it. I'm like, how can you have got to this age in life and not understand stamps? Have never used a birthday card by yourself, you know. I don't get stamps. Why do we have to use them?
At that point then, they've grown up with this resource. It's an amazing thing, obviously. As we know, the World Wide Web is an amazing thing. However, when it comes to whoever speaks the loudest, gets the most attention, the comparisons, the et cetera, we've talked about already. How do we guide in a world which is hugely unregulated and frankly quite worrying and scary most of the time?
I think the guide word's really important. I don't think there's a simple solution to it, but talking to your kids about what they're looking at, how they feel when they're looking at it, where they go for information, what counts as good information, why somebody might be authoritative or not authoritative, those sorts of questions in a non-judgmental way. I think sometimes as parents, we think our job is to instruct. It's like, I've got to tell my children the things that they need to know. And telling a child or a teenager very seldom has a good outcome. It doesn't achieve the end that we want. Whereas kind of wondering together, exploratory conversations, you know. And I my kids are old enough now that I can use myself as an example. And I was complaining, I won't name this person, somebody who I was following on social media, and how they made me feel inadequate and made me feel bad. And he was like, well, Mum, just unfollow them. It's like, yeah, okay, that's really smart. I should do that. He said, Mum, you've got to learn to curate your feed. And I thought, okay, so I have done a good job there. Because having those conversations, how does it feel when you look at it? Why do you think that person has the right to say that? I come along and say to my son, oh, you know, you should try a bit of mindfulness or meditation. He said, yeah, I follow a bloke on YouTube who, you know, I do that. He does cold showers before I took up cold water swimming because he'd heard about it on YouTube. But really being prepared to just talk in that non-judgmental way and that curious way and listen and allow the conversations to go somewhere. I think that's the only way that we are able to not inoculate them, but to help them have resilience to the all of that digital world.
We all need a bit of that resilience, especially working parents, I think, on a daily basis. Which then makes me think about courageous conversations and that strength and self-belief. And someone, I imagine you are good at having courageous conversations. You just strike me as someone with courage. And often, again, people I speak to, especially the women, working parents, women, will say, I can't have that conversation with my employer about flexible working. I can't have that conversation with whoever about. And it just seems to be that this resilience I just mentioned is lacking so much. Linked to everything we've talked about already, linked to confidence, linked to comparisons, linked to I'm not good enough. But how can we get better at knowing what our boundaries are and establishing those and being clear on them? That's one side. But then also being able to have those courageous conversations with employers, with family, with partners. How do we get ourselves to that place?
It's really interesting, I think. It's a great question. I am a brave person. So I'm very brave, very courageous, very able to step outside my comfort zone, to say difficult things, to ask difficult questions, except when it comes to figures in authority. And then I am a little wimp and I burst into tears and find those conversations really difficult. And I'm sure some of that goes back to kind of indoctrination as a little girl, you know, and trying to be good and lots of people pleasing there. And I find some areas, some conversations much harder. So I feel like I'd be a total fraud to give anybody advice on how to negotiate with their boss, because it's one of the things I find the hardest to do. But that in itself is interesting, isn't it? That, you know, that we can be big, brave women who are, you know, knowledgeable and capable, and yet still feel like we can't make ourselves unpopular with somebody who's in, for example, a position of authority or whatever. My advice to myself, and I do try and do this, is to practice. So if I know that I've got to say something, I will work out what is it I want to say. I will practice saying it out loud. And that sounds a bit bonkers. I might do that in the car. I might do it in front of the mirror, but I will say the words out loud, because when I say them out loud, you know, by myself, it becomes a little bit easier to say them out loud to somebody else. And, you know, I do have little phrases that I say to myself about putting my big girl pants on and things, and I will G myself up. but it doesn't come naturally. And I wonder how much of that is, you know, gender related or related to our experiences, you know, as children, as girls, as young women growing up. And I hope that we can just get better and better and better at that. But yeah, I'd feel like a bit of a fool telling anybody else how to do it, because I struggle, you know, I really do. I could stand up in front of 100 people, do a presentation, absolutely fine, no problem at all, very comfortable. But like a lot of women, asking for a rise to my boss or trying to negotiate something, bosses can make that easier or less easy though, can't they? And I've always tried, you know, when I was managing a big team, trying to be the person who they could talk to, really trying to be the person that people could talk to, and I hope has succeeded in that. But yeah, I don't know, what do you do? What's your advice?
Oh dear. Well, I think it's interesting that you say you are a courageous, brave person. Well, brave, I think there's two different meanings aren't into those two words, but a brave person in certain situations, which just strikes me again as that's okay.
Yeah.
And we can't all be courageous in every situation. We can't all have that all the time. We can't always be happy every single day. We can't, you know, all these things are ups and downs and nuanced and depending on our moods and the context. I think that's the first thing I noticed when you're saying that, is actually it's okay that you don't like talking to someone in authority, but you're great at 100 people in a presentation room, which scares the living daylights out of me, by the way. I think mine is just, what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah.
Part of my thinking is, how important is this to me, this conversation that I need to have? How important is it? What's the impact going to be if I don't have that conversation? And what's the impact or outcome if I do have that conversation? And where do I want to go with that? And if I really believe in it, and I can see that there will be a positive, potentially positive outcome, then what's the worst that can happen? Just go for it. Obviously, it's a bit of a risk analysis.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't have that conversation. There are politics. There are games to be played sometimes, especially in organisations. But I think it's, if you believe in it, really believe in it, then it's a conversation worth having.
I think that's great advice.
I should probably take more of my own advice. I think
we'll take more of our own advice.
I think we all should. Oh, I think to your point, take more of our children's advice.
Yeah.
Children are
very knowing. They are very insightful about us as people. And you know, sometimes they will point something out about us that we find difficult, but which is really true. Mm. Really, really true. You know, or mummy, you're being stressy or whatever it is. And you think, yep, you're right. I am. You know. Or as one of my sons once said to me, when I was particularly busy, he looked at me, I was sitting down on the sofa, and he came and looked at me, he said, why are you sitting down? And I suddenly thought, oh my goodness, that's because I never do, I'm always doing something.
It's their observations, I suppose. They are looking at us and at the world around them with such untainted eyes. You know, it hasn't been scarred by 30, 40 years of cynicism and everything else that comes along.
That's what makes them so wonderful, isn't it? They're so refreshing. And I think if I was to give advice to working parents about what really matters, it is to enjoy children, because children are wonderfully in the moment, wonderfully playful. And I know it's easy to say that, but you've got to have some bits of your life which are genuinely enjoying your children, because so much of parenting is complete drudgery. It's the difficult stuff. It's the, you know, all the paraphernalia of parenting, of getting them in the bath, you know, making sure they read and all the housework and everything else. And it feels hard work. But the sweet spot of children is when you're having fun with them genuinely together. That is precious. And we should make that happen as much as possible. And if the house is a tip, but we've enjoyed playing with our children, probably that's a better balance. Sometimes we do things, I think, as parents that give us the illusion of control. So I should own this one. I do things. So I will go around the house tidying up because it makes me feel like I'm on top of things. I'm like, yep, it's okay that my mind is settled because I've got control of my environment. But the most refreshing, the most energizing, the most relationship building moments with children are the ones when you're not really in control. You're having fun, you're in the flow, that moment of playing with them. And those are the ones that actually, that's truly rejuvenating to do that.
Well, I suppose as soon as you try and take that control, you're removing yourself from that situation, aren't you? You're suddenly, you're taking yourself away from it.
Yeah.
And as you say, from that flow, which is then actually very hard to get back into.
Yeah. And that's why adults can be rubbish at playing, because we want to control it. We don't want the dinosaurs to go in the farm because, you know, wrong era. Whereas kids are not like that. They are so much more open to things. And if they want to influence play, they know they have to influence their play partner. And, you know, they can't, if they tell them what to do and their play partner doesn't want to do that, then they have to change tack. So they are far more in the moment. And just, it's such a wonder. It's my big piece of advice to parents is find bouts of playfulness in your life with your children. It builds relationship, it builds their self-esteem, and it does us so much good. And it doesn't have to be hours. In fact, don't go to that theme park. Don't go to the petting farm. Don't do any of those things. Instead, spend half an hour doing something genuinely playful with your child, and you'll get so much more from it than, you know, some of the things that we do instead.
It doesn't have to cost money. As I say, it doesn't have to be these big sort of, it'll only be fun if we do X, Y, and Z. These very simple moments are actually much more powerful, aren't they?
Much more powerful. And I think children have become much more centralized in families now, in the sense that, you know, when I was a kid, my parents, the rhythm of their days, of their hobbies, of their weekends, that's what's governed our lives. So my dad played cricket, and therefore every summer at the weekend, it was all about him playing cricket. And we would just have to follow him around wherever he was playing cricket. Whereas now it's much more likely that parents would be following their children around their sports venues, their sports fixtures. We've really centralized children, which is a wonderful thing, you know, but at the same time, it squeezes out. So there's even less time for us.
Yeah.
Where did that time for us to relax and rejuvenate go? If we've got all of that work, we've got all of that, you know, mundane drudgery of parenting, and so much of our free time is revolving around what makes our children happy. There has to be something for us in there, and we can't thrive without some of that. So being a good parent to me is actually about looking after yourself as well, somehow finding a way to do that.
Yeah, it has to be. And it goes back to that original, you know, why are we centralizing our children so much? And is it actually for them? Or is it because we've seen all the other parents doing 15 clubs a week? So that our kids couldn't possibly miss out, so they better do it too. So is it, what's the motivation behind that centralization?
You talked about lockdown and you know, the pressures or the changes that happened there. And there was one bit of lockdown right at the beginning that I really thought, oh my goodness, something profound is happening here. And it was that real sense that parents and children got to spend more time together. There was this wonderful bit right at the beginning in the first lockdown where parents were saying, this is fantastic, I don't have to commute, I'm at home with my kids, I'm seeing them more. And it felt like there was a benefit there to be gained. And then, of course, you know, it all went on for far too long. We got traumatized by homeschooling, and work started to expand to fill that gap. So where the commute wasn't there anymore, we ended up working more hours, we ended up filling that time, and we just rebalanced. And we didn't keep the bit from lockdown, which was actually the really precious bit, I think.
Yeah, you're right. And I've got memories now of saying that, of being in the garden with no expectations because we couldn't go anywhere, we couldn't see anyone, all of that pressure was taken away.
Yeah.
And it was unadulterated, just family time.
And that walk, the walk that we were allowed to go on kind of, you know, once a day. It didn't matter if the kids stopped and, you know, looked at leaves, or we weren't trying to get anywhere.
No.
We weren't trying to do anything. And there was a little bit of slowing down there. I wish we could just remember that. Like, bottle it and have a little sniff of that every now and then. Say, oh yeah, I remember that. I need to do some of that this weekend.
Yeah, it's those words you just said. We weren't trying to get anywhere.
Yeah.
So how can we, even though we do have somewhere to go these days now, back to normal, how can we, let's see, recapture the essence of not having to go anywhere?
It's a really, really good question. I talk in the book a lot about mindset, about, you know, just standing down our executive functions, that efficiency thinking of always trying to kind of march through time, getting things done, moving on to the next thing. And coming into the moment a little bit and away from, you know, trying to achieve things. I personally, and I think lots of other adults, lots of working parents, I get high reward for achieving things. You know, I fire on those cylinders. I'm like, yeah, I did that. Well done me. And yet when you're with kids, you kind of need to stand that down and just be a little bit more, okay, look at that leaf. Let's, you know, spend a little bit longer doing this because it doesn't matter if the next moment comes, you know, really quickly. Let's just enjoy the one that we're in. So that really trying to enjoy moments and taking a breath and saying, yeah, let's spend 20 seconds longer doing this thing. It's okay to do that. And I think that takes a lot of practice, you know, stepping in and out of the work mindset being much, being prepared to go slowly on children, going with the grain of children at their pace is really helpful though.
Interestingly, I was thinking when you were saying that, I can do that with my dog. So when I take him for a walk, an hour walk, and it's always, it's an hour, so it has to be contained within the day, that's fine. But he can just meander and sniff around and go this way and come back that way. And I'm not telling him to come back or, you know, I'm going at his pace. I'm sort of following him around, really, I suppose. When it comes to the kids in the same park for the same hour, it's like, come on, hurry up. What are you over there? And it, I don't know why, because it's the same context. But the dog's allowed to go and do what he needs to do. But the kids are brought back into line more.
And we do that with so many aspects. You know, we read a book with them and we think the point is to finish the book. It isn't. The point is the experience. And, you know, and I say to parents, if you don't get past the cover, because you were having such a great conversation about the cover and about what it might be about and about the characters, fantastic. You still did a really good reading session. If you go to the park and you don't get, you know, past your front gate, well, if something great happened, brilliant. So it's about, I think, rejigging our sense of purpose and achievement and thinking this is about the experience that they're having. And I guess that's what I mean by playfulness, that ability to kind of step down from the next thing on the to-do list and put that away and say, that will wait. I mean, don't get me wrong. We all need to do stuff and achieve things as parents. But if we can protect time and, you know, and say, right, for this hour, we're going to the park. Or if we don't get to the park, we don't. But this is an hour in which the kids get to play and I get to be with them. Or even 15 minutes. I mean, you know, an hour is quite a lot. It could be just 15 minutes or 10 minutes in your living room on the floor with them. You know, set an alarm on your phone. And it's like after 15 minutes, then I'll get up and do all the other things. But until then, I give myself permission to completely just be with them.
But that, you see, already instills guilt in me thinking only 15 minutes. Oh, is that enough?
But 15 quality minutes of an evening.
That's my first reaction, you see.
Yeah.
Is that long enough? But again, it's like, yes, it is. For goodness sake, yes, it is.
It's, you know, 15 minutes more than you would have done. It's a fantastic 15 minutes. So I think it's all about context, isn't it? And congratulating ourselves. We do that at the end of the day. We think, oh, I didn't do that. Or, you know, I wasn't very good at this bit of parenting and I wasn't very good at that bit. If at the end of the day, we could just go, oh, but you know what? My child really smiled at me and that was fantastic. Or I did that one thing really well. You know, I got that one conversation okay-ish. If we could just look at what we're doing right, then I think that would be quite helpful.
Yeah. Well, my kids were out the door on time today without any shouting.
Well, well done you.
There we go.
That's pretty rare with no shouting.
I know. Maybe it wasn't. I don't think it was. Anita, thank you so much. As I knew it would be a very insightful conversation. And thank you for sharing all of your experiences, both personal and professionally. And if anyone wants to find out more about you or more about your story, where can they find you?
Well, you can probably just Google me on Anita Clear, which has an E on the end, or my website is anitaclear.co.uk. And there's all the information on there about the Positive Parenting Project, the services that we provide for companies in terms of workplace parenting sessions. But also I run private practice. I work with parents one to one. And of course, my blog, which is called Thinking Parenting. So I publish normally about every 2 weeks a new post on there, and that's completely free. And you can sign up for monthly newsletters. They're only once a month. I really do not have time to do them more than once a month. A little bit of positive parenting kind of advice or inspiration once a month into your inbox. That's a lovely way to stay in touch. And I'm on all the usual social media. You can click through from the website.
But not comparing yourself to anyone.
I I would be lying if I said I never compare myself to anybody. That would, I don't think I can claim to be that perfect. I am trying to get better in all aspects at all times. And that's one of the ones of trying not to compare myself.
Good. I actually recommended your blog to a client of mine in Sweden last week.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, who's having some issues with children and our parenting, etc.
It's not available in Swedish yet. We've got it. Mm-hmm. So the book's available in, obviously, in the UK. There's also a US version, which unhelpfully has a different title. It's called The Working Parent Survival Guide. Don't ask me. I'm not, you know, the publisher's made that decision. But it's I can't tell you how to pronounce the titles, but it's in Chinese, German, Polish, and Romanian as well. Okay. But I can't pronounce any of the titles.
I won't put you on the spot.
I didn't translate it myself. So that's available in lots of international editions, but not Swedish yet.
Not yet. Maybe if I spread the word in Sweden with future clients, maybe it will be. So thank you so much, Anita. Have a lovely rest of time in Portugal.
Thank you.
Enjoy the hybrid working. That's a very good thing to do.
I should try not to injure myself on a surfboard.
Yeah, no, don't do that. But great, you can go and do that this afternoon, though.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me, Aisha.
Thanks. Bye. To work with me, find out more at aishamari.com, connect with me on LinkedIn, or check out my free resources and quizzes at aishamari.com/resources.